This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. The last time I read for the Zesty Garden, I had been talking about Gertrude Jekyll. And before that, I had talked about Vita Sackville-West, two British gardeners looking at quite aristocratic gardens. Now I'm turning to simpler gardens, this time on the west coast of Canada in the 1800s. But before I do that, I wanted to remind you of the piece on zinnias that Vita Sackville-West read. She had had a gardening column in the London Times, and she wrote one piece on botanical howlers where the writer is way off base in something he or she's writing about. In this case, Walter Pater, the famous British person with emphasis on aesthetics, had written a book called Marius the Epicurean. And in that book, he had a Roman in his toga pinning a zinnia to his toga. And Vita Sackville-West points out that the zinnia hadn't been hybridized for some 12 centuries later. In fact, he was enriching Rome by a flower from a continent not due for discovering for some 1,200 years later. I suppose, she says, this must be granted under the heading Poetic License. Well, one of my listeners, a former student, reminded me that I had given her a poem by Ken Brewer, the, at that time, poet laureate of Utah. He and his wife, Bobby, were our next-door neighbors, and her gardens were colorful and beautiful. And sadly, it turned out that Ken was battling a terrible cancer. This is his poem called Zinnias Next to My Bed for Bobby. Yesterday, I was surprised by my wife with a vase on the table next to my bed and full of red, pink, and orange zinnias from our yard. Immediately, the room came to life. A brightness lodged within me, zinnias covering each spot of drab cancer. Tonight, sleepless after my first chemotherapy, I see the flowers each time I check the clock. When finally I sleep, I know I will awaken to zinnias, zinnias, zinnias. That was Ken Brewer's poem written on November 13, 2005. This could also be called not just Petals and Prose, but Petals and Poetry. I'm going to turn to another poem by a very famous Irish poet who died a few weeks ago, Seamus Heaney, a wonderful poet and a wonderful man. One of his friends and colleagues had written about him. Seamus Heaney's funeral in Dublin was televised live, marking an event that occupied the front pages in Ireland for several days. In his eulogy of the poet, Paul Muldoon told the story of being asked at customs on his arrival for the funeral what he did for a living. When he replied that he taught poetry, the customs officer said, "Oh, you must be devastated." No need to say why. The loss of the poet was felt everywhere. He had visited schools and given readings in almost every corner of the country, often for nothing. Thousands of people had seen him on television or had read of his Nobel Prize. The bleak fact that there would be no next volume of his poetry was grief to his readers, but even those who knew his work best were mourning the man as much as the poet. So this is a poem by Seamus Heaney called Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean, rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through the potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug, the shaft against the inside knee, was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down, down, down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mold, the squelch and sap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. And this brings me to thoughts about the metaphors that are shared by literature and gardening. I've been reading a book called Garden Plots, and you can have plots to a mystery novel or a story, and you can have plots of land. You can have seeds of thought and the scratch of the pen and the scratch of the hoe. You can talk about thorny issues and things can be transplanted. As I said, I've been reading a book about garden plots by Shelley Boyd, and in it she considers some early Canadian gardeners, among them Susanna Moody and her sister Catherine Parr Traill. They married friends and came from England to the west coast of Canada, where they immediately started gardens. And though these were not the lavish gardens like Vita's at Sissinghurst, nor all of the gardens that Gertrude Jekyll planned for people, well over 300 gardens, these were gardens of necessity for the most part. But they also, because these women were British, hearkened back to, there was kind of an archetypal presence in their minds, apparently, of the British cottage garden. And so the gardens that they created were of the cottage garden sort. And I interrupt myself here to say, my garden is essentially a cottage garden, and I feel apologetic about it because a cottage garden doesn't belong in the desert, and I know that. I'm just too tired, really, to xeriscape our place and plant desert things. Also, I happen to love the plants in my garden. The affinity between gardening and writing is something that garden historians and theorists, as well as authors, have promoted for decades. Gardens are rhetorical landscapes. They are made of the same materials as all the rest, just as the rhetorician's words are given by language, but they are composed to instruct and move and delight. Because the garden functions as a kind of readable text, it follows that not only plants thrive with it, but also thorny issues of class, gender, religion, and politics. Those values and ideologies pertaining to the social context from which the garden takes its form. A Canadian example of this kind of rhetorical analysis of actual gardens can be seen in Rhetoric and Roses, A History of Canadian Gardening. So these two sisters wrote to each other about their gardens, and it's quite revelatory of how their gardens must have looked. In the spring of 1839, Susanna Moody, a middle-class British immigrant, found herself living alone in the backwoods of Upper Canada, her husband John employed by the militia to pay the family's financial debts. Writing a wedding anniversary letter to her absent husband, Moody recounts how there were court writs against their cattle and how the children were rather ragged and bare without proper clothing. She included an imperative request of her own. "You must send me a pair of India rubber shoes to garden in, for I am without." Moody's sister, Catherine Parr Traill, shared the sentiment. A garden was indispensable. In Traill's Pioneer Manual, The Canadian Settler's Guide, readers learn practical gardening tips before they are educated in the essential task of making bread. Traill promoted gardening among the public and at the same time took personal advantage of those publishing opportunities, as she reveals in an 1882 letter addressed to her son William. quote, I get some things from Vic of Rochester and write for his illustrated magazine, and he sends me seeds for pay. I have sent him $15 subscriptions for his magazine since last May. I bless you in my heart. Paid in seedlings for her writing, Trail bestows tremendous material value on the garden. While both sisters view these terrains as vital to their daily lives, critics largely ignore this aspect of their domestic environs, even when the scholarship focuses on landscape and landscape's aesthetics. The majority of critics tend to discuss Moody Trail's physical and intellectual processing of the environment on a grand scale. But an argument can also be made for the centrality of the garden to the sisters' expression of the female immigrant experience. This book continues to look at their gardening practice, to present the letters that they wrote to each other about their gardens. And so it's a book that I recommend to you as a very interesting view of early Canadian gardeners. And soon I will turn to gardeners on our own continent. It's been a pleasure to talk with you about these things and to think about them far beyond what I've been able to share. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose.